we'll go on to the next case, which is 072989, Eshmuel Rennert versus Great Dane Limited.
Your Honors, may it please the Court. I'm Bruce Paff, and I represent the estate of Deborah Rennert. Illinois strict products liability has never been so limited as the District Court ruled in this case. Illinois strict liability allows people who can, in a reasonably foreseeable manner, come into contact with a product that's unsafe, bring an action. The District Court held that, in fact, one must be an actual user of the product, that is, in the vehicle itself that you claim is defective, before you can bring an action.
We've got to start, I guess, by talking about maybe the Illinois Appellate Court in Beatty, which plainly thought that Mears' logic forecloses the very type of strict liability claim that you are asserting here. So I guess that's where we need to...
Absolutely. Beatty and Myers are cases that are at the heart of what we're talking about. If I can start with Myers, Your Honor, the logic of that case was that the event was so unforeseeable and extraordinary that liability should not be imposed. That was carried forward in the Beatty decision. And in Beatty, the aspect that I consider significant is while the manufacturer in that case was sued for the same defect that we're suing on here, that party was not dismissed. That issue was not raised on appeal.
Can I say, Mr. Pfaff, I mean, I have a great deal of sympathy for the position you find yourself in because you began this case in state court. In this case, arguably belongs in state court because what you are fundamentally arguing, I think, is that times have changed, understandings have changed, and maybe the Illinois courts would take another look at this particular class of accidents if they had the opportunity. That's why you filed your certification motion. But all of that said, what would help me is if you could give me any tea leaves or anything that comes from either the Illinois Supreme Court, preferably, or if need be, the Illinois appellate courts, that would make me think Illinois is in the mood to change these rules.
Certainly. Historically, we have to look at where we began. Suvada was 1963, the first strict product liability case, 64, first strict products case in Illinois. It did not deal with a user of the vehicle, but in fact someone in another vehicle who was injured because of defective brakes. Meyer comes along and says what it said. What happened after that, we have the decision that the defense cited in Winnett, which actually supports plaintiff's view, that if in fact plaintiff can meet the burden, that the plaintiff was a reasonably foreseeable person to come in contact with the product, the case deserves to go forward and the judgment was affirmed.
But at what level of generality are we speaking? We have these sort of broad statements from Illinois that it follows 402A and that it, you know, recognizes strict liability. And then you get this very specific ruling in Mears, about these rear-end underwriting collisions. So is the specific now going to move over onto the side of the general?
Could I just add something? I don't mean to double team, but you know, of course, Beatty's 1994, and the Illinois courts are still citing Mir on other points.
Other points, exactly.
But that's...
That decision, Your Honor, I tried to call it an outlier in the district court, and that's my opponent has reminded this court of that characterization. Other than being an outlier, I believe it's wrong. It may not have been presented appropriately because the data about the number of underrides, their reasonable foreseeability, and the mayhem that underrides cause, that literature has been out there since 1971. There was a notice of proposed rulemaking by NHTSA in 1969. That was never presented or considered by the court in Meyer. It was not really addressed in Beatty. All Beatty described was an earlier version that put a duty on the owner of the vehicle, not on the manufacturer, not on the distributor, none of the parties who could be before this court. The Palmer decision, Palmer versus AFCO, also held that if you're a reasonably foreseeable user, this is Illinois Supreme Court 1980, you don't have a reasonably foreseeable in contact with a product, not a user of the forage wagon or whatever the other product was, you're entitled to have that product be reasonably safe, and it's not. If it's not, you're entitled to compensation for the injury.
And are you the first one to come along since 1994, if there are all these cases out there? No one else has been before Illinois.
There are no reported decisions in Illinois on this issue. Cases have been filed. No reported decisions.
And then what about additional data since Beatty? You know, you alluded to these studies that occurred pre-Beatty. Had there been other studies post-Beatty?
Absolutely, and we cited those at page 11 and 12 of our opening brief, that I think the time period was 1997 to 1980, and it studied rear-end impacts where a non-truck, that would be a passenger car or an SUV-type vehicle, hit a large truck or trailer in the rear,
but
60%
of
the time.
But I meant, I knew you had that, but I meant more, even more recent than that.
No, other than, well, defendant's appendix includes data from 2004. In their appendix, they cite the CFRs that there were over 11,000 rear impacts involving trucks in that year, and there were 500 deaths in that time period and more than 5,000 injuries.
Then what doesn't the silence of the Illinois courts tell us something?
I'm not sure what it tells the court, because this court has to sit in the view of the Illinois Supreme Court, and I would submit that's a position that I don't think the Illinois Supreme Court would follow Beatty. This court, I think, is aware that there are 12 cases that we have cited, both in our opening brief and the reply, where if a vehicle is not safe to crash into, liability has been imposed. Six of those are exactly the same fact pattern here. Where
these are your cases from other states.
Yes, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So Illinois
still hasn't.
And actually, there's sort of a second level problem, I have to say. That comes up in a lot of those cases, not your case, as I understand the pleadings, which is the preemption issue. I mean, your opponents sort of dance around it. They say no, there's no allegation that their particular truck didn't comply with the NHTSA regulations. And the Supreme Court, as you probably know, last week even, was taking a pretty aggressive view about the depth of federal preemption in other areas, medical devices, tobacco sugars.
But under the Motor Vehicle Safety Act, a number of those out-of-state cases that we cited to Your Honor rejected the preemption defense.
And I'm saying that was then, this is now. Is it now, in light of Regal, do you think they could?
I believe that the preemption answer would remain the same, because the statute still says compliance with the federal motor vehicle safety standard does not eliminate liability under the common law. That remains the statute. There may be changes under individual motor vehicle standards, such as 208, the airbag provision, and potentially under 216. But with what we're dealing with here, no. The results should be the same. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Mr. Derbyshire. Ash, I wonder where your ancestors were from.
They came from England, Your Honor.
I'm
Glenn Derbyshire from Savannah, Georgia, which is the home of Great Dane, and I'm here with Robert Carson from Gould & Ratner, our counsel here in Savannah.
Nice to have you.
Thank you for this opportunity to speak to you today. If you've got a few just short remarks off of my opponent's arguments, the Beatty, I call it Beatty or Beatty decision, he notes that the manufacturer in that case had its motion dismissed and did not take an appeal. That was Fruhoff. Fruhoff went bankrupt in that time period. I'm not sure it's in the record of that case, but the fact that Fruhoff did not prevail and did not appeal can be explained for any number of reasons. It does not indicate that it was a decision on the merits that was not appealed.
Well, a number of the cases that the Illinois Supreme Court cited in Muir for the view that a manufacturer's duty is limited to making the vehicle safe, you know, for those who ride in it, were subsequently overruled. And that includes our own decision in Evans versus General Motors, which we overruled a few years after Muir was decided. Is that a basis, perhaps, to think that the Illinois Supreme Court might reach a different conclusion today than it did in Muir?
I do not think so. I think the Illinois Supreme Court would hold to the distinction between a vehicle that is safe to ride in and one that is safe to collide with. The social policy underlying the recognition of strict product liability that goes back to the 60s was one of spreading of losses and putting incentives where the incentive on the manufacturer where it's appropriate to make a difference and make the product safer. In defining the limitation in Meyer, it was a social consideration or a public policy decision to just limit the realm of exposures for vehicle manufacturers that they don't have to make their vehicle safe for others to run into, and that's because of the vast, vast array of possible crashes, vehicle sizes, speeds, offsets, and the just innumerable possibilities for people being injured by the other vehicle that's being run into.
And yet, if you analyze all of this, the Illinois Supreme Court has been looking at the restatement, and one of the themes that runs through this is who is the least cost avoider. If it costs $100, and I'm just using hypothetical numbers, for Great Dane to put guards on the back of their trucks, and you were going to save $1 million each time somebody ran in to a truck because people wouldn't be killed or maimed in horrible ways, you know, maybe it is worth putting these things on. That seems to be what the National Highway Transportation Agency has concluded.
That's a tremendous if, and Your Honor, I would disagree with you in terms of what NHTSA, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, decided when it issued the regulations in 96 requiring configuration changes and strength requirements for guards. Of the 423 fatalities through rear impacts out of the roughly 40,000 fatalities on the highway and all types of accidents, 423 were rear impacts, fatalities, and they said, let's make the guard lower, wider, with specific strengths, and we hope, we'll save 4 to 15 lives. That's 1 to 4%. There were so many accidents because of speeds, high speeds, or because of degrees of offsets, and the science, it took them 35 years to make that regulation. They were very limited in what they thought they could achieve. And that's why it's consistent with Meyer for a court to say these are extraordinary events. Not that people run into the back of trailers, but that a guard caused a fatality.
Well, the failure of a guard, I suppose, is more accurately, I think the failure of a guard caused a fatality.
It's such a narrow range of speeds that can make a difference in possible accidents that it is indeed extraordinary, as Meyer decided. And the Beatty decision is correct. There are other states that have supportive law. We've cited a California case and a Texas case that are not rear underwrite cases, but they do hold to that. I'm also limited by your circuit's rules on citing unpublished decisions or non-published decisions from
other
states.
You're allowed to cite them now. We just don't promise to pay any attention to them.
Yeah.
So we do have California cases in compatibility where an SUV is too high and runs over a car. We have, in fact, recently a trial court decision in California in a rear underwrite setting. It was a twofold decision. The plaintiff's expert was not sufficiently reliable to be admitted. But beyond that, they said the federal standards for strength and energy absorption and guard performance are what a manufacturer must meet, and in California, not more. It's just a federalism decision that states can, in their common law, define the extent of that exposure to their own state standard. And that's what we submit has been done here. The cases where...
Can I ask you to address for just a moment the request for certification here? Because I think you can show fairly persuasively that if there is no reason to think that Meyer and Beatty are going to be changed, they certainly favor your position. But there has been more general development in the law, as Judge Rovner was saying, and other states are approaching this differently. Why shouldn't we just ask the Illinois court, since it's Illinois law?
Well, under your case law for certification and the rule that as it's interpreted, you would do it only if the Supreme Court is not clear or if the courts of appeals are in disagreement where they are not in disagreement, and here we have the Beatty decision only, you give great weight or deference to that decision, and that is a First District decision. And so without some type of conflict among the courts of appeals, where you have a consistent decision at the Supreme Court level, precisely in this factual context, it seems that to be certifying it would really be imposing on the state court just the request that you make the decision for us and we'll follow it. It's not warranted under the rule as it's interpreted in your presence. That's the all-state decision.
I understand that. What troubles me about this, though, is if this case had stayed in state court, mm-hmm. Litigation would have proceeded under what I like mm-hmm. to think of as as a dynamic process where the state courts are entitled to develop their own law as they wish. By moving to federal court, you get a snapshot, because we, of course, can't change state law. We have to take it as a snapshot, even if we thought that there's some movement afoot. And so how we bridge that gap and still remain faithful to the commands of Erie and the like, that we really do function the same way a state court could, is a very difficult problem.
There will inevitably be times in which cases are inconsistent within our system of federalism. It just works that way. We would submit that our client has the right under the federal system to remove to federal court and have these judges make that decision. And that
it was
that
the
right
longest
is
jurisdictional
a,
list I've seen maybe ever. The list.
Through the limited partnerships, we do have a number of family members who are partners.
That's right. I should have so many cousins.
Yeah. Of the cases cited from other jurisdictions, not all are rear underwrite. Many are conspicuity cases or lighting cases. They are just different factual patterns. The Rivers decision is an Alabama case that Alabama federal court case that interprets Florida law. It's just simply different. It's just, as part of our federalism, Florida law is just different. Turns out in that case, ultimately, it turned down to a manufacturing defect claim. We would not be arguing that Beatty prohibits a manufacturing defect claim if the guard were not built according to standards that we set internally or by the federal standard. There would be a manufacturing defect claim. So it's not that there is no cause of action possible in these contexts. It's just that in this state, there are not duties to go beyond what that federal and state by adoption regulation requires. Thank you.
Mr. Braff, 2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of brief points. Counsel's argument adopts the idea that if they, by design, they had put a spear at the back of this trailer pointing rearward for another car to be impaled, that there's no liability. And I don't mean to be facetious, but that's their argument. Their argument is they have no duty to make a vehicle that's safe to crash into. They had a guard. It was ill-designed. There's a distinction with Meyer. Meyer was no guard. I think that might make a difference in how the Supreme Court were to look at this. What tells this court that the Meyer result, that this was an unforeseeable event, would be different today? Number one, we have two regulations adapted by NHTSA in the late 90s that provide for protection of occupants in the rear-ending vehicle. There could be nothing to say that that event is more foreseeable than the implementation of those regulations, which required this defendant to put a guard on its vehicle. I would point out that there is no state that in a strict liability context says that this defendant would go free without a trial on the facts of the case. There is no state that rejects a strict liability claim under the facts of this matter. There's only the negligence claim that we have here from the Meyer case and then the Beatty decision from the Illinois Appellate Court, which, as this court sits, judging as the Illinois Supreme Court would do, this court is not bound by Beatty, and I would submit Beatty is simply not worthy of following in light of these other facts. The regulations that NHTSA adopted were post-Beatty, and I think that's very significant.
Thank you very much
Thank
to
you,
all counsel.